Welcome to our second conversation with Mauri Takianagi and Melanie Unwin, curators of the Voice and Vote exhibit at the Houses of Parliament. I'm Amy Griggs with BritishHeritage.com, and I had the pleasure of hearing firsthand about this groundbreaking exhibit. It's set to open on June 27th. As you know, this year marks the 100th anniversary of women achieving the vote in the UK. This exhibit walks you through 200 years of suffrage history. Melanie and Mauri now explain the space in Parliament known as the cage. Join me for this segment, and I think you'll be as amazed and moved as I am by the story of women's long struggle to be a part of political life. Let's move on to the cage. Now, that name intrigues me. What does the cage look like?
The cage is, so the Houses of Parliament burned down in 1834.
Yes.
Charles Barry is commissioned to build the brand new building, which we still see today.
Yes.
And the Houses realised that, well, the House of Commons particularly realised that women needed to have a space. They realised that, you know, after the ventilator, women were always going to find their way in. So they decided that they would make a separate space for women. Now, unlike men, the public, who were all men at that point, as far as everybody was concerned, who had a big gallery in one end of the House of Commons open to the common space, as indeed the public gallery is today, women weren't allowed in that gallery. They were going to have a special space that's at the other end, high above the speaker's chair, high above the press gallery, which is the next layer, right up at roof level. They had a ladies' gallery, but wasn't open to the chamber itself. It was behind a stone screen with windows in it, and the windows didn't have glass in them. They had decorative metal grills. Now, these metal grills were not to stop the women falling out, which they might have done. They were a long way up, they're very big windows. They weren't for their safety. They were to stop members of Parliament on the floor of the House seeing them and being distracted, because they thought if the MPs could see the women, they'd be distracted.
Oh, okay.
So the women were behind these grills, and it became nicknamed the cage very quickly because they were like birds in a cage.
Oh,
they were
God.
Up there and held
and these
in.
Are these are the portions of the grill are the things that are on display now. In the central lobby.
Absolutely. When they were eventually taken out in 1917, just before women, some women got the vote, but the writing was on the wall.
So that was the whole second half of the 1800s, right up to 1917.
Yes.
That was their only access.
It was.
Oh, my gosh. And I remember in another podcast we did, you talking about the women that were so sick of it, they chained themselves to the grill.
Yes.
And had to be taken out on the grill.
That's right. So this is the space that was used first by the peaceful suffrage campaigners, the suffragists in the late 19th century, and then by the militant campaigners, the suffragettes in the early 20th century. So Millicent Fawcett, the great suffragist leader, she called it a grand place for getting headaches because of the difficulty in peering through the grill and trying to focus through the gaps. So the grills, the women asked them to be removed almost from the start, but the MPs always refused to do so. And so the grills became both a physical and a metaphorical symbol of women's exclusion from Parliament, hence the targeting by the suffragettes. As you're remembering there, it was 1908. Suffragettes from the Women's Freedom League, Muriel Matters, who was an Australian suffragette, and Helen Fox chained themselves to the grill and had to be, were frog marched out and had to be cut off in a committee room nearby. And the third suffragette, Violet Tillard, dropped a banner through the grill into the House of Commons to a great uproar.
Yes, that's one of my favourite stories. Mm. And you said that banner
yes.
is still...
The banner will be in the Voice and Vote exhibition. You'll be able
wonderful.
To see it this summer.
Right. That is fabulous. The 1866 petition. Can you explain that to me?
Yes. So the 1866 suffrage petition marks the start of organised suffrage campaigning in the UK. So although there are isolated examples of women campaigning and indeed having petitions presented to Parliament, it's not till 1866 that a group of women bands together, decides they want to present a petition to Parliament and tries to organise it on a sort of mass basis. And so this was organised by women belonging to the Kensington Society, which was like a debating society for where for a sort of middle class women, the kind of women who would have definitely gone to university had they been allowed to in this period, but couldn't. So instead, they discussed things and campaigned and tried to improve the lot of women in higher education. They discussed suffrage one day and then decided that this was so outrageous they wanted to try and argue their case before Parliament. And John Stuart Mill, who was a Liberal MP and a philosopher, well known MP, agreed to present it, providing they could get at least 100 signatures. And they they got 1,500. Yes. And although that's a long way off what was to come, which is many tens and hundreds of thousands, petitions over many years, if you think what it must have been like for women in 1866 without any of the modern telecommunications we have today, you know, trying to gather, you know, 1,500 signatures, which came from all over the country, all over England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland, which was part of the UK at this time, and even some British women living abroad. It's quite a remarkable achievement. They use their families and friendship networks to go, go out, collect signatures. They went up and down the streets where they lived. They asked the wives of their butchers, grocers, bakers and so on and so forth. As I say, got this all-women petition. They brought it to Parliament. Elizabeth Garrett, who became famous as the first woman doctor, and Emily Davis, a great campaigner for women in higher education, brought it to Parliament. And they brought it to Westminster Hall, the exact place where our exhibition is going to be. So you can come and see our exhibition and imagine Emily Davis and Elizabeth Garrett bringing the petition there in 1866. And it was quite a large roll of names, and they were embarrassed wandering around the hall holding it. So they asked an old woman selling fruit if they could hide it under her stall. And that's where it was when John Stuart Mill came to pick it up shortly afterwards. So Emily Davis related this tale many years later. And it's a very lovely story. And that's where it all began.
Melanie, the bolt clippers...
The bolt clippers
are actually an American item.
They are Porter's bolt clippers. Porter's from Boston.
Okay.
After the suffragettes chained themselves to the grills, parliamentary authorities realised they needed a quicker way of getting them off, because on that occasion they actually had to take the grill out with the women still chained to it and take them out and saw them off. So they bought a pair of Porter's bolt clippers.
Just to have on hand.
Very, very quickly they came into use. Only a few months later, women from the Women's Social and Political Union, Pankhurst organisation, came in to St Stephen's, which is a corridor full of statues of men, on the way to Central Lobby, which you come and see when you come and visit Parliament. And they weren't allowed to go into Central Lobby anymore. They had to sit in St Stephen's. Only men were allowed to go through to Central Lobby at that stage. They all sat down next to statues. And on a given signal, they leapt up, and underneath their clothing, they had chains, and they chained themselves to four of the statues. And we are very lucky to have the police report in the parliamentary archives detailing what happened. And the Porter's bolt clippers were sent for, and they proved extremely useful. And it was all over in about 7 minutes, it says.
Oh, really? So 7 minutes?
Yes, they came and they clipped them all off with the bolt clippers.
Oh, gosh. And you have the clippers?
We actually have them. For many years, Mari and I have been thinking, God, wouldn't it be wonderful if we found the bolt clippers? I wonder if they're sort of downstairs in a cupboard at the back of the cupboard somewhere. And we was mentioning this to one of our volunteers who used to be the principal doorkeeper in Parliament. And he's now a volunteer now. He's retired. And he looked very thoughtful. And he came back after his lunch and said, is this what you are looking for? And he had on his iPad a photograph of the Porter's bolt clippers, and they are still kept in the principal doorkeeper's office.
Just in case.
So we are very lucky. So we found the original Porter's bolt clippers, and we are going to have them on display in the exhibition.
Oh, that's hysterical. Now, in this period of time, while women were working for getting the vote and for getting more power, Alice Hawkins...
Yes.
Now, that's someone you can tell me about, Melanie.
It is. We are extremely lucky in the exhibition to be having Alice Hawkins' family's collection of her suffrage-related items, yes. Sashes, hunger strike medal. Alice Hawkins is really important because a lot of people think that it was middle-class women who were doing all the campaigning. Right. It's absolutely not the case, certainly not in this country. Alice Hawkins was a working-class woman. She was a machinist in a shoe factory. She had a large family of children. And she was a trade unionist, an early trade unionist, and she fought for better working conditions for women. But without the vote, she felt that working women's conditions were never going to be taken seriously unless they could vote. People would just ignore them. And so she became a suffragette. She joined the WSPU and she took part in all sorts of protests. Indeed, she went to prison on a number of occasions, and on one occasion she went on hunger strike. And I think what's really interesting about her is, you know, she came to London. She went and met the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer on a working women's deputation, which was organised by the Pankhursts. So she was involved in London, but she also established the Leicester branch of the WSPU. And even when she was in prison, she spoke to the wardresses about what their working conditions were. So she was always interested in the working women. So even these women who were responsible for keeping her in prison, she was interested in them. And one of the really exciting things that we have is a letter to Alice Hawkins from somebody who signs it M. Hulse. But the address on the top of the letter says in handwriting, it's from the prison. And I think everybody had assumed this was from another prisoner.
Oh.
But, and I have to say, Murray's the one who did the research. We suddenly thought, this is really kind of not, it just doesn't feel quite right. What was written in the letter didn't entirely sound like it was from a prisoner. And a bit of research on the old census. And she was the matron. She was wardress.
Matron. She's,
the matron of the prison. And so she's writing to Alice afterwards saying that, you know, she's hoped life is returning to normal and that she's got over her experience.
Oh, my
gosh. So she clearly had a very close relationship.
Yes.
Isn't it interesting?
It is. We featured Alice Hawkins in one of our Wednesday's women.
That's right, because she's recently had a statue.
She's had the statue in Leicester.
Yes.
And I corresponded with her grandson or great-grandson.
Peter, yes. Peter Barrett.
And the website that they keep going in her memory is just a wonderful resource.
It's great.
It is great, and it's definitely worth understanding her story as a working woman.
And she was very lucky because she was a working woman. You know, she had to work herself as well as this time in prison was lack of income into the household. She was very lucky. She had a very supportive husband. Not all suffragettes' husbands were supportive, but Alice's was, and indeed, he was actually arrested himself at a suffrage meeting. Well, at a meeting he was disrupting. So Alfred Hawkins is very crucial. And, you know, it meant that she was able to do more, even in her very limited free time, because she had a supportive husband. Some suffragettes were thrown out of their homes. You know, they were unemployable because employers didn't want somebody who was involved in this terrible, you know, campaign. So she was very lucky, but it meant that she could, you know, really fight actively in the things that she believed in.
So there is an anti-suffrage doll in this area?
Yes, so one of the very wonderful objects that we're going to have in the Voice and Vote exhibition, which is on loan from a private lender, is a doll. And it's quite small, maybe sort of 10 inches high or so, and it's made out of wood. And it's a suffragette, a hostile depiction of a suffragette, because she's got her mouth open like she's shouting, and she's holding a sort of large handbag which has Votes for Women on, just so left in no doubt. And it's similar. She looks quite masculine. There are anti-suffrage postcards of the time, and we've got some of those as well in the exhibition, which depict women in the same way as these sort of harridans who went around shouting and waving their handbags and breaking windows. It's a very rare item, this doll. We showed it to experts and they've never seen anything like it, but it's definitely a genuine item from the period. What we don't know really is who bought these dolls, and we think you didn't necessarily have to be an auntie yourself to look at a doll like this and maybe find it amusing and buy it. And the same with the postcards, which were manufactured in large quantities, and the same manufacturers would make both pro and anti-suffrage cards. And again, suffragists and suffragettes may well have bought the anti-cards just because they found them amusing and posted them. But it's certainly an interesting way of throwing light on this unexplored area.
Yes, yes. Okay, so we have the changes in the second half of the 1800s and the cage, which is what you're representing and where women were made to try and listen.
Absolutely. You'll be able to go and sit in the cage and you'll be able to listen to debates of the period. So you'll really get that impression of what
we'll
it was like.
Feeling. We'll definitely have the feeling. So let's just close this section. Mari, if you could tell me a little bit. There was somebody very interesting in this depicted in this section, Constance Markovitz.
Yes, so this is how we're ending the cage section with the election of the very first woman MP.
Yes.
So in 1918, first of all, some women get the vote, the big anniversary of the year that we're all celebrating. To vote, you had to be over the age of 30 if you're a woman, and you had to meet minimum property qualifications. The reason for this was to avoid women outnumbering men in the electorate, because as we've just been discussing, there was a lot of fear about this. So it was thought at the time by Parliament that you needed to put a cap on the number of women voters, and that's how they chose to do it. But the same year, they also passed an act that allowed women to become members of Parliament to stand for election. And it sounds very curious, but there was no age limit and no property qualification for that. So you could be elected as a woman MP from the age of 21, the same as men, and without any regard to your property. And because there wasn't any fear that women MPs would outnumber male MPs. I don't think anyone in their wildest dreams thought that women would be elected in large numbers, especially since they've managed to cap the number of women voters.
Right.
Anyway, so at the end of the year, in December 1918, we have a general election and 17 women stand and one is elected, and that is Constance Markovic. And she's very interesting in many ways. She is a suffragette by background. But from the point of view of her election, when she stood for election, she was actually in a prison cell in Holloway, just where suffrage prisoners have been held just a few years earlier. Indeed. And the reason she was in prison was because she had previously been in prison for her role in the Easter Rising in Ireland in 1916.
Yes, she represented a district in Dublin.
That's right. She was elected for Dublin St Patrick's, and she stood for the Sinn Féin party because she was a Republican and believed that Ireland should be independent from the UK. By 1918 she'd been arrested because, you know, we were at war people like her were interned. So she wrote her election address when still in her prison cell for the voters of Dublin St Patrick's, and then lo and behold, she was elected. She never took her seat at Westminster. And the reason for this is because Sinn Féin MPs don't do that to this day. They don't want to swear the oath of allegiance to a crown that they don't believe that they should be under. And Constance Markovic sort of said this very strongly in her election address. And so she never came to Westminster. She did, though, take her seat in Ireland in the Irish Parliament when that was set up afterwards.
That was the first one.
Indeed. Yeah. And became a Minister for Labour in the Irish Parliament. So one of the earliest women cabinet ministers in Europe.
In all of Europe, they said. Yes, indeed. Well, she was interesting, and she poses quite often with her guns and her... I think her group, when she was doing the rising, her group was the last one to let go of the building they were holding. She had a group of soldiers fighting to the very, very, very end.
Yes.
So she was quite a brave fighter and warrior as well.
Indeed, yes. One of the other 17 candidates was another Sinn Féin candidate who was known as the typist with the gun, because she turned up for duty with a typewriter and a gun. She didn't get in. She was standing in Belfast. But,
That is an apt ending for the section called The Cage.
There's much more to hear in the final installment of our Voice and Vote podcasts. Next time, we'll learn about both the tomb and the chambers, the challenges faced by Nancy Astor, and historic changes to the House of Lords. Be sure to join British Heritage Travel all summer for our Wednesday's Women series on Facebook. We profile an extraordinary, history-changing woman each week. And by spending just a couple of minutes with us every Wednesday, you can learn a great deal about the history of women's voting rights in the UK and the US. So until next time, I'm Amy Griggs, and this is BritishHeritage.com. Thanks for listening.